Once, public schools were hubs of childhood health care. The UH School of Nursing and the state DOE are looking to bring back those days with the expansion of its program, Hawaii Keiki Healthy and Ready to Learn. As it moves into the third phase in the coming school year, the goal is to have the program in all 15 complexes. With school set to start on August 1st, what can parents statewide expect that may differ from their experiences last year? Dr. Mary Boland is the Dean of the University of Hawaii at Manoa School of Nursing and Dental Hygiene, and she's with us today with some of the details. Hello there. Nice to talk to you. This program has been in effect since 2014, at least in its beginning stages, its planning stages, and then into the piloting part of it. But it seems that in this third phase that will start with this coming school year, that it's really coming into its own. What has happened up to this point?
Well, thank you, Beth Ann. We're really delighted to be able to grow the program. It started in 2014 with the new school year, recognizing that within the DOE schools, there were high-need schools or schools where children were eligible and receiving free and reduced lunch and were at very high risk for not accessing health care. Although 98% of children in Hawaii have Medicaid or health insurance if they need it, they were not accessing those services. And the conversation essentially turned to, what if we bring the services to the children and the families and the parents?
Which seems kind of logical because that's where the kids are and you have the greatest chance of reaching the greatest number of children, you would think.
It's quite different from how healthcare is delivered. If you think of your own experience, you take yourself either to your primary care physician or the urgent care or the emergency room. Very unusual for healthcare to be where you are. So that was our driving force, to essentially increase access. We also knew that absenteeism was a large problem in DOE. And as DOE drilled down, they identified health-related factors that were impacting that in some schools more than other schools. So we came together because we have a joint mission essentially to create opportunities for higher education for children. We want the students coming into nursing at UH to be well prepared. And we started to look at what were some of the traditional models out there, what was happening on the mainland, what would fit in terms of Hawaii, and came up with a model where we started by placing APRNs or nurse practitioners in complex areas where superintendents identified a need and, more important, where schools had principals who said, yes, this is a resource, a service that we will welcome onto our campus.
So how big was the pilot itself?
The pilot started off essentially with four nurses. We were on Big Island, on Kauai, and then on Oahu. And then we've grown from there. We were fortunate that the healthcare community joined us. And so Queens Health Systems, as well as Kaiser Permanente Hawaii, HMSA Foundation, Hawaii Community Foundation, others, Castle Foundation, really came forward and said, we would like to work with you to develop what we call proof of concept to see, you know, we know there is a need, but is this model going to work within our communities?
And that seems to be where you've come to at this point, and now having had that proof of concept moving through the school systems to be able to have a school nurse who is there responsible for each complex area. When we talk about, you know, the school nurses, and people may have certain ideas about what a school nurse is and what he or she may do, this is not necessarily the school nurse of yore, right? I mean, this is somebody who is well connected to a system in a way that the school nurses of long ago just weren't because there was no need.
Exactly. It's not your grandmother's or your mother's school nurse. The DOE schools have what are called school health aides, which are high school graduates with some training that are based at the schools. Very committed for the most part. And the model that we have then is working with the school health aides. And then Hawaii has public health nurses, Department of Health public health nurses, who've been available to the schools as consultants. So the idea is that those two components with a nurse practitioner then working with the superintendent to identify what are the needs in the complex area. So whereas a traditional school nurse sat in a health room, if you will, waited for a child to come in, this new model now, our APRN, is out throughout the complex area. They spend a couple of days a week located at a school determined as having need by the principal and the superintendent. but available to the entire complex. We've also launched a web-based health record-keeping system. So when that's fully implemented, the nurse can be anywhere, essentially, and be able to access the child's health information, health records, see what, how many times they've been in the health room, what is the issue that the school health aide may be calling about today. It's sort of a, it's not telemedicine, but it's a, it provides that increased access.
As you have a lot of the kids who are on Quest, this school nurse is also going to be responsible for filing some of those Quest forms. Is he or she not?
Correct. We're asking parents at the beginning of the school year, with the package of papers that come home, will be a consent for the Hawaii Keiki program, and we'll be collecting history on the child that will be used to update the record that the school has. Again, take it from that little card in the index box to a health, electronic health record that can follow the child from elementary school up to middle school up to high school. That's our ideal. And then with parents' consent, nothing would ever be done to a child without consent. The nurses support the health aides around emergency or just the routine sick call in the health room. But when the child has a chronic condition or something that's impacting attendance or performance, then the APRN is able to provide service to the child. We're also seeing that many of the children on Quest, while they again have the services, they've not accessed them. So they can be behind in their routine exam, their vision testing, hearing screenings, et cetera. Our goal is to get them to their primary care site, whether that's a community health center or a pediatrician's office. Lacking that, we are in a position where we can provide services, particularly for those children with chronic conditions, and really partner with the pediatricians or the primary care providers, as well as Kapi'olani for the children that have specialty health care needs.
There are schools who I can imagine are just chomping at the bit to have an APRN located there. You have one per complex area. That's a lot of kids for which that one person is going to have to be, you know, circulating and be responsible for, notwithstanding the fact that you've got aides and others who will be there, other nurses of different types there. What would it take to be able to get a school nurse back in every school, someone who would be really responsible for this at a higher level than just, say, a health aide?
I think it's the direction that DOE wants to go, and certainly support from the legislature is critical. States that have done this, and I'm going to use Massachusetts here, has a lot more children, obviously, but they've actually shown that for every dollar the state invests in a school nurse, there's a savings of $2, both to the MedQuest, their Medicaid MedQuest type program, as well as to parents not losing time from work. One of the things we hear the most from parents is that it's just hard for them to be able to do everything when they're working sometimes two jobs and have children in multiple schools. So our thinking is, again, by accessing services, we'll be able to make life easier for parents.
What about expanding to some of the other adults who are at the school to make it a true health hub?
We're starting to see that, and it certainly was one of our long-term goals, was not only the adults at the school, but parents as well, and again, through partnerships with other providers. But our nurse practitioners are family nurse practitioners, which means that they can provide services to adults and children. And our goal, the model that we follow really is a joint educational CDC model that essentially says, make the school the hub, provide health services where everyone is, and ensure a healthy community. Because teacher sick calls are just as critical to schools. You know, no one likes to see a sub have to come into a classroom.
And teachers aren't necessarily the best in taking good care of themselves either, because they're trying to take care of everybody else.
Exactly. They're just so committed to the kids and the schools.
Thank you so much, Mary, for coming in. We wish you lots of good luck, and we'll be watching this program as it blossoms over this next school year.
Thank you.
Dr. Mary Boland is Dean of the University of Hawaii at Manoa School of Nursing and Dental Hygiene. Together with the Hawaii Department of Education, they developed the Hawaii Keiki Healthy and Ready to Learn program to improve the health of kids at school. The program will expand to all complex areas in the coming school year. Thank you.
Support for The Conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, whose students contribute 60,000 hours of community service annually. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, Lee Cataluna's latest, but first, here's your backyard quiz.
For today's backyard quiz, we're exploring the arrival of coffee in the Hawaiian Islands. It was 1825 when Chief Boki, then the governor of Oahu, acquired coffee trees in Rio de Janeiro while he was on his way back from London. He had them planted in Manoa Valley. Over time, coffee trees made their way to other parts of Oahu and to the neighbor islands. Now, these trees require six specific conditions to thrive: rich soil, proper elevation, sunshine, cloud cover, rain, and proper drainage. Now, some good coffee comes from climates that offer just a few of these conditions, but Kona offers all six. Hawaii is the only U.S. state that grows coffee commercially. Collectively, we produce 7 to 9 million pounds of green coffee beans annually. Do you know the name of the person who was responsible for planting the first coffee trees in Kona? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know. And we'll have the answer for you in the second half of the program.
Aloha, I'm Ainoa Naniole from Hilo, Hawaii. If you like today's music, find the playlist at The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Hundred 45 crew members participated on board the Hokulea in the Malama Honua worldwide voyage. Many thousands more participated from land, following the voyage over the World Wide Web. And case in point here, Vince Ferrant, a recent Kamehameha School graduate. Welcome, Vince.
Aloha. Nice to be here.
Oh, so glad you're here. And with you, Miki Tomita, Hokulea crew member and organizer of the Malama Honua Summit for Hokulea's worldwide voyage.
Thanks for having us here.
Oh, yay, Miki. So glad you're here. Vance, I wonder if we could just chat a little bit first about your experience with the Hokulea.
Sure.
I mean, you followed it as part of a celestial navigation class, and you followed online, but you also had kind of a personal connection to the crew members.
Right. Our teacher, Darren Kamalu, has two daughters who are apprentice navigators, Noe and Lehua. And so we had that connection to the voyage on their many legs that they helped to navigate. And through that, Mr. Kamalu was also familiar with many other people at PVS. And along with Mr. Christopher Blake, he also had connections to Miki, other people. And so we were able to talk with Kumu Nainoa Thompson. And we were able to have many opportunities to go on the Va'a Hiki Analia at METC on Sand Island. And we were able to connect with the Va'a, the voyage, in those ways.
PVS, Polynesian Voyaging Society. And so you were able to do it physically as well as online, which makes a big difference,
yes,
right?
It did.
And what were the most exciting maybe legs of the voyage for you?
Well, the most exciting leg that I found was the Galapagos to Rapa Nui leg, where I think Lehua and Noi were both on that, the Kamalus, and through their navigation updates where they would talk to the camera and tell where they thought they were, the weather conditions and so on, they would update us, and you could tell their determination in finding this island, which had never been done before, I believe, without assistance.
Rapa Nui.
So, yes. Mm-hmm. And it was them re-entering the Pacific, Hokulea coming back into the Pacific for at least one of the first legs back in the Pacific. And so it was amazing to see their determination coming back into the Pacific to find this small, small island and overcome that challenge.
How did they do it?
And you'll have to look at their navigation updates. I'm not quite there yet on finding Rapa Nui myself. But
look at everything they put together, right, Mickey? The analysis and everything that they're reading physically as well as mentally.
Yeah, so the apprentice navigators, as Vance was saying, Noe Lani Kamalu, Lehua Kamalu, Honani Kane, and Jason Patterson on that leg, there was the first... So Rapa Nui is the smallest navigational target in the world. It is the hardest island to find, the most isolated landmass in existence. And our four young navigators pulled her out of the sea and re-entered the Polynesian Triangle, which was an amazing feat. They trained for years and years under Nainoa and other master navigators to be able to interpret and to explain how they calculate their course and their directions and the speed at which they're traveling, all based on sea swell and winds and stars and other signs from nature. It's an incredible experience, and we were so honored to just watch them accomplish such an amazing feat.
I like how you put it, pulling that island out of the ocean the way Maui did. Mm-hmm. It feels that way.
Certainly does. To pull an island from beyond the horizon is something that all navigators and apprentice navigators, they train to be able to do. And inside all of us, we learn from our pull and our leadership that the dream for Hokulea and the Worldwide Voyage is to really inspire people to pull their own future out of the sea of possibilities in front of them. Young people like Vance to be able to say, this is what I want to do and this is where I want to go in life. And you may not be able to see the island that I want to pull from the sea, but I can visualize it and I will set my course on it.
Mm-hmm. Could you feel being on the canoe, Vance?
I definitely, towards the end of this voyage, this worldwide voyage, even more so as they're coming home, have felt more and more connected. It's, you know, when they're a world away in South Africa across the world, it's hard to feel the connection sometimes, or you forget, you know, in your everyday life, you forget this amazing voyage that's happening around the world. But as Hokulea has been coming home, every time you get the chance to talk about Hokulea or go to an event or anything related to this voyage, it's an amazing feeling of being connected to something that I wasn't aboard the canoe, I wasn't on that voyage, but at the same time, you were. And so it's amazing just knowing that Hokulea went around the world. And one thing that stuck with me is one parent that said that their kid's going to grow up in the world knowing that Hokulea went around the world and did this voyage. And that's just a reality that they're going to be growing up in. And so that I'm sure those kids will feel very much a part of what this voyage has meant.
You know, that's a great perspective, Vance. Thanks for pointing that out. Now, we've got a summit coming up, the Malama Honua Summit, that's really going to drive home the messages of the voyage.
Yes, it is. And as Vance was saying, when we face our new realities and we see that in 42 years, Hokulea has accomplished the impossible, sailed to Tahiti for the first time in 600 years, trained new pole navigators, master navigators in the old ways, and took them around the world, sailed this double-hulled traditional voyaging canoe guided by stars across the entire ocean to come back home to these waters and to bring with her upon the decks of her canoe and within the hearts of our crew members the thousands of stories from the communities that we've met. Bring them home to us at Magic Island at Kalia into Ala Moana and the convention center, and to celebrate the effort that has gone into this incredible, what some would call impossible feat. But then to convert that and to celebrate all of the effort that could happen if we were all concentrated and focused on taking observations and taking action to achieve the impossible, which is really a better world for everyone.
It does at times seem impossible, you know, it does. But this gives one a little bit more hope, right, Vance?
Hope is definitely one of the key words to go back to with this voyage. And I know one of the other words that just keeps coming to mind for me is inspire. And that's what Hokulea, I think, has done in so many ways, inspired to look to the past, look to the present, look to how you're living your life, and then be looking to the future and how you can use what this voyage has done and all that it represents, these stories, everything that Hoku let us bringing back from this worldwide voyage, how do we use that in the future? And so I think it's inspired students like myself, I'm sure younger students as well, the coming generation, as well as older generations that were perhaps not as inspired before to go out and live their life in a way that will be making a difference. But now people have a reason, have hope to go make that difference.
It's been done. It's been done. And you've partnered with so many elementary schools all the way on up. You've been part of the education component of this voyage. Mickey, it's really been amazing.
You know, it has been. And we've been, again, so inspired by the stories of hope that have come out of our communities locally and globally, connecting with thousands of educators worldwide, broadcasting live from the deck of the canoe and engaging with thousands and thousands of students at home and abroad. And really asking everyone to share with us in small ways and big ways how they work to Malama Honua, how we all work to care for and steward our precious island home,
the legacy. What can we do going forward?
You know, it's I think taking every opportunity to think about what is the best way that we can celebrate oceans and land and life and community and language. And people can do big things like sign up to be a part of the Aloha Plus Challenge and Dashboard. They can join collaboratives like our Va'a Talks that were sponsored by four major institutions here that brought together thousands of educators to talk about how voyaging influences their teaching. They can train to be crew. They can do beach cleanups. They can just celebrate kupuna and really invest in our local communities and getting our children involved.
We'll start at hokulea.com to find out the schedule that's coming up in the Malama Honua Summit. That's one of the organizers, Mickey Tomita, with us today. Vance Ferrant, recent Kamehameha Schools graduate, in fact, valedictorian for the 2017 class. Congratulations, and thanks for coming in, both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, wishing all students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve Hawaii Home Access. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
A bill sitting on Governor Ige's desk would prevent the state from issuing new permits for aquarium fish collection. Some say the measure is a compromise for fighting factions. CivilBeat.org reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Hi, Chad.
Hi, Beth Ann.
Now, for some, this whole issue of aquarium fish collection is a moral issue. For others, it's a matter of their livelihood. For everyone, though, it's contentious. Is there really a compromise to be struck in this bill?
Well, that's a good question. I'm thinking of it as the Finding Nemo bill, or maybe the Catching Nemo bill is what we should call it. In fact, it's a yellow tang fish here in the islands that are very popular. But what Carl Rhodes was concerned about, he's the author of the bill, is that you do have to be concerned about sustainability. I think we're all very conscious right now of overfishing. And even though this is not fishing for ahi, for tuna, you know, for consumption, and it would be putting fish into aquariums where other people can enjoy them in their home, there is a concern that maybe we are depleting the stock. And so what the bill would do is give the Department of Land and Natural Resources the authority to ban these permittings. But there would be some grandfather language. Existing permit holders would still be able to have this until 2022. They could even transfer that. DLNR would also have to submit a report on how the stock is looking. Is it being sustainable, our nearshore aquatic life? So the way Rhodes looks at it is this is a slow motion thing. It's not going to put an industry out of business right away. This could actually take 30 or 40 years. But top of mind, we want to make sure we don't exhaust the fish.
Is there any indication that this bill is or isn't on the governor's veto list, which we're all supposed to see by June 26th?
Right. The governor, no governor that I know of, well, with maybe one or two exceptions, normally don't show their cards. You just don't want to do that. In fact, on the 26th, the governor will have to identify the bills he's thinking about vetoing. And the actual veto deadline would be, I think, July 11th. So this is to give the legislature some time if they want to try and tweak it. There is talk, as you know, about a special session regarding how to pay for rail. The lawmakers could also take up other bills, including this one. But no, the governor is not showing his hand right now where he stands.
But there's a lot of lobbying going on both sides. I mean, we've been hearing
Absolutely.
This just out in the wind.
Yeah, I mean, the fishing industry, and by the way, it's a $2 million industry, they say, look, this is a safety issue. If you're going to stop issuing these permits, that's really going to affect our business. That means we're going to actually have to go in and catch the fish ourselves. That could put people at risk. Rhodes says, you know, that's kind of a bogus argument. We're only talking about the people that go in the water with the nets. In fact, there are only about 50 active commercial aquarium fish permits, and some of those permits haven't been used in years.
What about the conservation groups? I mean, obviously, this is a step in the right direction as far as they're concerned.
Oh, yeah, they absolutely support it. Groups like the Humane Society, for example, they are worried a little bit that DLNR doesn't do a very good job handling the aquarium industry. They're worried that there's no limit on the catch. On the other hand, Suzanne Case from DLNR says, look, I think things are pretty stable. There's no indication of a significant decline in populations of fish where they are collected. You know, it kind of depends, as Nathan Eagle wrote in his story. It's sort of the glass half full, glass half empty. You know, some think it's going just right. Some others say no. But one important takeaway from his story is that the data is a little fuzzy. There is different interpretations of exactly how sustainable those fish stocks are.
And just for everyone's knowledge, how many permits are we really talking about? How many people rely
according to Nathan's reporting, there's only about 50 active permit holders. I mean, that's certainly, if you're a permit holder, that's important to you. That's a not insignificant population. But as Rhodes pointed out, many of these permits have not actually been used in recent years.
Going back to the fuzzy data.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, Chad, glad to have you back. We'll talk to you sometime soon.
Thanks, Bethan.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Chad Blair.
Aloha, I'm Tracy Yamamura from Hawaii Arts Alliance. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
Months ago, Meals on Wheels became the example of what could be lost should federal funding be cut as proposed in the president's budget. That funding comes from the Community Development Block Grant. With roughly 3 months to go until the end of the 2017 fiscal year, and with it, the federal budget, the organization says it's getting intimations it will receive less funding in the 2018 budget. Lori Lau is the director of the Meals on Wheels for Lanakila Pacific Health, and she's in our studio now. Good to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
There was a lot of concern 3 months ago, but there was also a lot of information that wasn't exactly clear about how, for example, Meals on Wheels was funded, and it's one of a number of organizations that get money through the block grant. And the idea that if the block grant went away, well, obviously that might mean the money would go away for organizations such as yours. In the ensuing time, we've seen things calm down a little bit. But then again, you're looking at the end of this fiscal year right around the corner. What have you been doing in the interim to be able to plan for what could happen? And clearly, none of us knows.
You're absolutely right. The federal funding for the current budget is only good through September 30th. And so at the Lanakila Meals on Wheels program, we certainly have been looking forward and making plans in terms of what we can do as an organization to continue to support our seniors should we receive less federal funding next year.
You serve many seniors, and there are still many that you can't serve. What does that ratio look like?
Well, this year we're on track to serve over 2,500 seniors. In terms of meals, we translate that to over 400,000 meals that we'll provide island-wide. We also know that there is a number of seniors on the wait list to receive meals. And so the wait list varies from time to time, but right now it's over 200 individuals that we're still hoping to serve.
How much does it cost for you to be able to provide a month's worth of meals to a senior?
We are able to provide a healthy and nutritious complete meal for less than $200 a month per person.
And that's one meal per day?
One meal per day.
So very clearly that there would have to be something that fills in those other gaps. But even getting one meal per day for $200 sounds like it's a good deal for those who need it and maybe the only lifeline that they have. And to say nothing of the only visitor that some seniors may have, too. Are these basically seniors or couples who are still living on their own, not with any other family?
The majority of our seniors are living either on their own or with a spouse of similar age. And you're absolutely right. For the majority of our seniors, we are a lifeline. Something that we do with the Lanakila Meals on Wheels program is we do provide emergency food to individuals when they call us. And our team has gone into people's homes when there is literally nothing in the pantry and nothing in the refrigerator. And the senior has called us after maybe gone one or two or even 3 days without any food. And so definitely the need is there. And we're providing a fundamental service, which is just to feed people.
Food, when people hear about a senior going hungry for 1, 2, 3 days. I mean, there's an emotional reaction to that. But the bottom line of it is for you, you can't give what you don't have. So in the event that you see some of this federal funding being cut, looking to the state, looking to hospitals, looking to individuals to try to be able to bridge that gap?
Mm-hmm. So you're absolutely right, Bethann. We do receive funding from different sources. We do receive maybe about 15% of our funding through federal funds, maybe another 35% from the state. As you mentioned, we do get money from the healthcare providers, but the rest of the meals is unfunded, and in that we rely on the community for support.
But that might ratchet upwards if you see some of that 15% go away, that part that you receive from the federal government. And should the state or hospitals and other health care providers not be able to kick in, what are you doing to be able to bring up your strategy and create maybe a different arm?
Well, we definitely are looking at partnering with some other groups. We have benefited from different communities' supports and foundation support. And so really it is put on our Lanakila Meals on Wheels team and Lanakila Pacific to make sure that we look at ways of partnering with the community in order to continue to provide these meals. While we look at funding from these government sources going down, our commitment is to make sure that we continue to provide for all of the seniors in our care and those that continue to have need. That is our goal, and that's something that we're going to continue to strive to do.
Right. I mean, still, it's the bottom line if you can't do what you don't have. Because you operate on Oahu, I can imagine you get a lot of calls from neighbor islands saying, but what about senior folks over here? How well networked are you with the neighbor islands, and how are you seeing those networks that you've just talked about, even on Oahu, expanding into areas that perhaps you'd never considered before?
You're right. You know, we do get calls from the neighbor islands and even people from Oahu that want to sort of transfer their services because they're thinking about moving to a neighbor island. And so we are connected with the providers on the other islands, and we can make that warm referral to make sure someone doesn't fall through the cracks.
But for those additional folks who you may not hear from, or those who feel like they don't want to burden their, you know, their society, their family, you're talking about a generation of people who were pretty tenacious lot and were pretty self-reliant. What do you have to do to get to some of these people especially if they don't have family.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. You know, working with this population, I realize how much pride they have. You know, they've spent their lives raising their families and working jobs and taking care of their community. And they're not a group that wants to ask for help, you know. And these are folks that have contributed for their entire lives. These are school teachers and service industry workers and hospitality industry workers. These are our neighbors. And it's come to a time where, because of their own personal limitations, they're not able to care for themselves anymore. We have outreach workers that go out into the community. We connect with local churches and senior organizations. We go into senior housing units, farmers markets, any places where there might be a community of seniors that we can talk to. And we try to explain to them what the program provides, and we try to make it so that it's okay for them to ask for the help that they might need.
Well, we hope they ask for help, and that you also see more networks open up where we can be assured that no senior goes hungry. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Lori Lau is the director of the Meals on Wheels for the Lanikila Pacific Health.
Aloha, I'm Bianca Dukeshire from Honolulu, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
I know it's a long time since this morning, but chances are pretty good that you started your day with a cup of coffee. It may even have been brewed from beans grown right here in the islands. Today, around 7 to 9 million pounds of coffee beans are produced in Hawaii annually. Known for its rich and smooth taste, Kona coffee has become one of the most expensive coffees in the world. Ideal growing conditions in Kona allow for coffee to thrive, but Kona is no longer the only coffee growing region in Hawaii. There are farms in Kau and Puna, upcountry Maui, Oahu's North Shore, Molokai, and Kauai. Kona is still the best-known coffee producing region in Hawaii, though, and for today's backyard quiz, we asked you to name the man who first brought coffee to the Kona coast. The answer is Samuel Ruggles, a missionary from Connecticut who planted the very first coffee tree in Kona in 1828 from Brazilian cuttings.
We had a winner on that, Beth Ann. Todd Bernardi of Haiku. How's that?
Well, that is the answer. Thank you so much. You'll be receiving the prize. And if you've also got a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Well, it's a pleasure, aloha, to be sitting across Will Kahele. Hi, Will.
Hi, aloha nui.
Office manager, actor, director at Kumukahua, which is Hawaii's playhouse for work by and for Hawaii.
Correct, yes.
Yeah. Your co-director of Lee Cataluna's new play, Uncle's regularly scheduled garage party, is canceled tonight.
Mm-hmm.
With Harry Wong.
Yes.
The other director.
Yes.
And congratulations on it.
Well, thank you.
Real romp.
Thank you. Yeah, they're having a lot of fun.
How do you describe what happens in this play?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's a, it says it in the title. It's a regularly scheduled garage party, someplace where everybody gathers every week. And they take their autumn food and they take their stories. And it's a community thing, you know, and everybody knows each other. And on this particular evening, it's canceled. So everybody comes anyway because, you know, that's where they always go. And then they have to find out why it's canceled. And but
well,
they
but
still
I mean,
come.
They might as well stay because they already brought their potluck food.
Yeah. And they're talking
so
story, and they're eating, and they're singing. And the more that people come, the more people get into it, and then we find out why the party is canceled.
We do?
Maybe.
Yeah, well, I mean, are parties like this still happening? Do you have a party like this in your life, Will?
When I was growing up, we had parties like on holidays and special occasions. And we'd always go to Waimanalo to my Uncle Danny and Auntie Janice's house. And the whole family from around the island would, you know, travel there. And it would be a weekend thing. And so the uncles and aunties would, you know, gather in the garage and eat and drink and play music. And
what kind of food?
Oh, my gosh.
Like, what did you have?
I would say mostly Hawaiian menu. You know, I mean, we had squid lau, lau lau poi, rice, kalua pig, you know,
chicken
whatever.
Long rice.
Yeah, chicken long rice. Yeah. And it would all be in the kitchen. And of course, you know, the kids had to wait on the adults first.
Yeah.
And then once that was done, you know, we could run across the street, go to the beach, spend all day there.
Yeah.
When the sun went behind the ko'olaus, then we knew it was time to come back to Auntie's house, take a shower, and then relax. And then, you know, watch the adults play Paiute or other card games.
What happened to card games,
yeah,
man?
Yeah. And they used to play card games, and we used to watch them get silly and get, you know, inebriated.
All like that. And that's when you can lie down and you could still see the waves breaking in front of your face.
Oh, my gosh,
and your skin still.
We would fall asleep and wake up, and they would still be playing cards. You know, I was like, oh, that's pretty cool.
Now, those are some days, right? Do you think they still happen here in Honolulu?
Oh, my gosh. You know, with my family, I think we've all grown up, and each separate family has their own, maybe.
Mm.
I don't think anyone has taken up the mantle to invite the whole family over like we used to before.
Well, hard to all fit in the apartment.
Yeah,
right?
And it, and it's hard to fit. And
let's
a lot of us have moved to
the
mainland, or to neighbor islands or something.
Mainland.
So it's not as frequent as we'd like to.
And everybody's so busy. It's really hard to schedule this stuff.
Yeah, yeah, correct. It's
you got to book it like a couple months in advance, 1 month in advance.
Yeah, and now you go on Facebook and you say, can you come? You go, no, I can't make it. So you see it in pictures and you go, oh, looks cool.
What are we touching back on when we think about a party like this? I mean, you know, when I think about Lee Cataluna's plays, they're recalling such flavorful and warm things about Hawaii that we used to have in common, I know.
I think what we're touching on is a community of sorts. Why do we all come to these parties? Just like, you know, what you said, why would you come to this party? It's part of, you know, touching on your memories and your feeling for these people around you and what everybody brings to the table.
That's the hilarious thing, is the types and what people bring. Like, really hilarious. This couple comes and they bring, you know, prime rib and lobster claws and everything. Like, oh, no, it's nothing.
Creme brulee.
Yeah, creme brulee.
But that's part of what they give.
Yeah,
you know?
It's not unusual for them.
Yeah. And they say, oh, no, it's nothing, You know, but that's how they give to, you know, to their
And then another,
their family.
A couple of guys come in, and then you realize that they had just seen the party on Yelp.
Yeah,
and
they somebody put it on social media, and that's how they found it. And said, oh, no, you know, this thing, it happens regularly, and, you know, there's pictures even. And, so that's kind of cool.
It really is. You dragged it into the present somehow.
Yeah. And even when the audience comes in, you know, they're already playing music in the garage, and you know, we tell everybody, well, sorry, the party's canceled, but you're invited to stay if you want. So.
Did you figure out exactly, I mean, as you went into the character development, what each person actually would bring in, as their potluck contribution?
A lot of it is kind of, you know, stated in the script. So we try to follow the script as much as possible.
What Lee said to do.
Yeah, so we have like sashimi, or sometimes we have dry aku.
Oh, yeah, I noticed that. It looked good.
Yeah. We have chicken katsu. I know some of the script says stuffed squid.
Stuffed squid?
Stuffed squid. I've never had that at, you know, hour gatherings.
I've never had that.
I think that might be a special Cataluna family
maybe
thing.
It's a Kauai thing?
Maybe, or Maui thing.
Maui thing?
Yeah.
Whoa, stuffed squid,
hey,
Lee.
You know, that's why she got the creme brulee and the lobster and fried
some
rib.
Of the, yeah, those are some of the Lahaina people.
Yeah, they party. Yeah. They don't have a party.
Well, geez, it's so much fun to head over to Kumukahua, which is still, this is the last play of this season, right?
This is the last play of this season, yeah.
And you're looking ahead to next season.
We are our 47th season.
I know, it's amazing.
Yeah.
You got some good things coming?
We have four new plays next season, and world premieres, and one by Ed Sakamoto called Dead of Night that we did, I think, back in 2001. Very interesting play about the Union.
How do you get these new plays? I know that you're intimately involved, Kumu is, in developing new work.
We try to look for local playwrights or plays in development, and then we try to foster the play development and help the playwright to workshop their plays. And we have readings, and Harry will, you know, try and guide them along. And
what can someone do if they think, geez, I think I've got a play here, but I just don't know where to start?
You know, Kumukahua offers a lot of playwriting classes throughout the year. And it's a great deal, and sometimes they go for 6 weeks. Mm-hmm. And it's like one class a week. And we have very talented playwrights. And at the end of the 6 weeks, you will have at least one act finished. And
oh,
then,
that's
you
great.
Know, we try to give you a reading that, you know, actors will read the play for you, and then you can take it from there. I have a play that's still in development that I think has been, for 6 weeks. And
ooh,
I have others on
great.
The back burners,
of course.
You know. But
there are other people out there, too, and Kumu will help you get your play up and running.
Because this is what, you know, Kumu is for. It's for the local voice, the local actors, local playwrights, local stories, and what we see and what we know.
And we got to have it on stage.
Yep.
So that's how to do it. And support Kumukahua by maybe investing in a season ticket for their upcoming season. It's going to be fantastic. Find out all about it through their website. Will Kahele, our guest today, co-directed Lee Cataluna's new play, Uncle's regularly scheduled garage party, is canceled tonight. See it at Kumukahua Theater through July 2nd. And find out more at kumukahua.org.
Oh, mahalo. Thank you. Thank you, Noi.
Thank you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
There's always so much going on throughout the state, and you might not know that Morning Edition host and my colleague Derek Malama kind of shepherds all the events that go on in the community calendar. Every now and then he comes in to maybe tell us about some things that might be happening under the radar.
Yes, Noi. Speaking of which, there is a clothing drive on Oahu dedicated to supporting Hawaii's children and families in need. And this year, the Locations Foundation is teaming up with the United Cerebral Palsy Association, the Institute for Human Services, and Kapalana Homeless Family Education Program. So from now until Friday, they're asking for donations of lightly used clothing, as well as shoes or slippers, linens, towels, and items that people might use for a job interview. And the Locations Foundation will donate $1 for every pound of clothing received, with the goal of providing 15,000 pounds of clothing and $15,000 to families in need. Drop-off sites are at Locations real estate offices, and also at Pearl Ridge Center and the Windward Mall. For more details, please go to our website.
So many of us can hardly go into a supermarket without having rat lungworm on the brain, right, Derek?
Yes.
We need more information, I think.
Right. And you can find out in a talk tomorrow on the Big Island. They will cover the State Department of Health will cover these topics. Is it safe to eat local lettuce? How much washing of fresh produce is needed to be sure we're safe? And what's the best method to wash produce?
That sounds like good questions.
Those are questions that are on my mind. This informational program is free to the public, and it's tomorrow at 5:30 on the Big Island in the Kealakekua Library.
Mm-hmm. And back on Oahu, Flag Day.
That is tomorrow. Yes, the Pearl Harbor Visitor Center celebrates Flag Day with a free concert. The U.S. Pacific Fleet Band Wind Ensemble will perform a free concert of music. The ensemble is directed by Lieutenant Kelly Cartwright. And once again, this is taking place tomorrow, Flag Day, from 8 to 10 a.m. at the Pearl Harbor Visitor Center.
Very cool. Thank you, Derek Malama. He joins us on the conversation to take a closer look at some events in our community that might be going on under the radar. Thanks, Derek.
You're welcome.
Jia Zhang was terrified of rejection, so he decided to treat it by seeking out rejection.
I'm going to walk into a local business and do a staring contest with the CEO. I'm going to ask someone to open up their backyard and for me to play soccer in it. I want to get my hair trimmed at PetSmart today.
And he did all this to become a better version of himself. A better you on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Saturday at 3 p.m.
Thanks very much for joining us today for the conversation. We hope you're going to come back tomorrow. We're going to look at a new study that says even moderate drinking could impair your brain. Mm-hmm. Jabson's Dr. Bill Haining will break it down.
And we'll take a look at what's happening at Bishop Museum, home for so many of Hawaii's most precious artifacts. Interim President Sissy Farm will visit. We'll also welcome Na'alehu Anthony, Chief Executive Director of OEVTV, also crew member of the Hokulea. He traveled the most dangerous leg and was responsible for making sure we all were there via the web.
If you'd like to comment about anything you've heard on the program, you can call our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or find me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed part of The Conversation or anything else, find it on air at the new HPR app. I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We will meet you back here tomorrow with more of The Conversation.